Heretics by G.K. Chesterton, an Adult Brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. Introductory Remarks on the Importance of Orthodoxy. Nothing more strangely indicates an enormous and silent evil of modern society than the extraordinary use which is made nowadays of the word orthodox. In former days, the heretic was proud of not being a heretic. It was the kingdoms of the world and the police and the judges who were heretics. He was orthodox. He had no pride in having rebelled against them. They had rebelled against him. The armies with their cruel security, the kings with their cold faces, the decorous processes of state, the reasonable processes of law, all these, like sheep, had gone astray. The man was proud of being orthodox, was proud of being right. If he stood alone in a howling wilderness, he was more than a man. He was a church. He was the center of the universe. It was round him that the stars swung. All the tortures torn out of forgotten hells could not make him admit that he was heretical. But a few modern phrases have made him boast of it. He says, with a conscious laugh, "I suppose I am very heretical," and looks round for applause. The word heresy not only means no longer being wrong, it practically means being clear-headed and courageous. The word orthodoxy not only no longer means being right, it practically means being wrong. All this can mean one thing, and one thing only. It means that people care less for whether they are philosophically right, for obviously a man ought to confess himself crazy before he confesses himself heretical. The bohemian with a red tie ought to pique himself on his orthodoxy. The dynamiter laying a bomb ought to feel that whatever else he is, at least he is orthodox. It is foolish, generally speaking, for a philosopher to set fire to another philosopher in Smithfield Market because they do not agree in their theory of the universe. That was done very frequently in the last decadence of the Middle Ages, and it failed altogether in its object. But there is one thing that is infinitely more absurd and unpractical than burning a man for his philosophy. This is the habit of saying that his philosophy does not matter, and this is done universally in the 20th century, in the decadence of the great revolutionary period. General theories are everywhere contemned. The doctrine of the rights of man is dismissed with the doctrine of the fall of man. Atheism itself is too theological for us today. Revolution itself is too much of a system. Liberty itself is too much of a restraint. We will have no generalizations. Mr. Bernard Shaw has put the view in a perfect epigram. The golden rule is that there is no golden rule. We are more and more to discuss details in art, politics, literature. A man's opinion on tram cars matters, his opinion on Botticelli matters. His opinion on all things does not matter. He may turn over and explore a million objects, but he must not find that strange object, the universe. For if he does, he will have a religion and be lost. Everything matters, except everything. Examples are scarcely needed of this total levity on the subject of cosmic philosophy. Examples are scarcely needed to show that whatever else we think of as affecting practical affairs, we do not think it matters whether a man is a pessimist or an optimist, a Cartesian or a Hegelian, a materialist or a spiritualist. Let me, however, take a random instance. At any innocent tea table, we may easily hear a man say, "Life is not worth living." We regard it as we regard the statement that it is a fine day. Nobody thinks that it can possibly have any serious effect on the man or on the world. And yet, if that utterance were really believed, the world would stand on its head. Murderers would be given medals for saving men from life. Firemen would be denounced for keeping men from death. Poisons would be used as medicines. Doctors would be called in when people were well. The Royal Humane Society would be rooted out like a horde of assassins. Yet we never speculate as to whether the conversational pessimist will strengthen or disorganize society. for we are convinced that theories do not matter. This was certainly not the idea of those who introduced our freedom. When the old liberals removed the gags from all the heresies, their idea was that religious and philosophical discoveries might thus be made. Their view was that cosmic truth was so important that everyone ought to bear independent testimony. The modern idea is that cosmic truth is so unimportant that it cannot matter what anyone says. The former freed inquiry as men loose a noble hound. The latter frees inquiry as men fling back into the sea a fish unfit for eating. Never has there been so little discussion about the nature of men as now, when, for the first time, anyone can discuss it. The old restriction meant that only the Orthodox were allowed to discuss religion. Modern liberty means that nobody is allowed to discuss it. Good taste, the last and vilest of human superstitions, has succeeded in silencing us where all the rest have failed. 60 years ago, it was bad taste to be an avowed atheist. Then came the Bradlaughites, the last religious men, the last men who cared about God. But they could not alter it. It is still bad taste to be an avowed atheist, but their agony has achieved just this, that now it is equally bad taste to be an avowed Christian. Emancipation has only locked the saint in the same tower of silence as the heresiarch. Then we talk about Lord Anglesey and the weather and call it the complete liberty of all the creeds. But there are some people, nevertheless, and I am one of them, who think that the most practical and important thing about a man is still his view of the universe. We think that for a landlady considering a lodger, it is important to know his income, but still more important to know his philosophy. We think that for a general about to fight an enemy, it is important to know the enemy's numbers, but still more important to know the enemy's philosophy. We think the question is not whether the theory of the cosmos affects matters, but whether in the long run anything else affects them. In the 15th century, men cross-examined and tormented a man because he preached some immoral attitude. In the 19th century, we feted and flattered Oscar Wilde because he preached such an attitude, and then broke his heart in penal servitude because he carried it out. It may be a question which of the two methods was the more cruel. There can be no kind of question which was the more ludicrous. The age of the Inquisition has not at least the disgrace of having produced a society which made an idol of the very same man for preaching the very same things, which it made him a convict for practicing. Now, in our time, philosophy or religion, our theory, that is, about ultimate things, has been driven out, more or less simultaneously, from two fields which it used to occupy. General ideals used to dominate literature. They have been driven out by the cry of art for art's sake. General ideals used to dominate politics. They have been driven out by the cry of efficiency, which may roughly be translated as politics for politics' sake. Persistently for the last 20 years, the ideals of order or liberty have dwindled in our books. The ambitions of wit and eloquence have dwindled in our parliaments. Literature has purposely become less political. Politics have purposely become less literary. General theories of the relation of things have thus been extruded from both. And we are in a position to ask, what have we gained or lost by this extrusion? Is literature better? Is politics better for having discarded the moralist and the philosopher? When everything about a people is for the time growing weak and ineffective, it begins to talk about efficiency. So it is that when a man's body is a wreck, he begins for the first time to talk about health. Vigorous organisms talk not about their processes, but about their aims. There cannot be any better proof of the physical efficiency of a man than that he talks cheerfully of a journey to the end of the world. And there cannot be any better proof of the practical efficiency of a nation than that it talks constantly of a journey to the end of the world, a journey to the judgment day and the new Jerusalem. There can be no stronger sign of a coarse material health than the tendency to run after high and wild ideals. It is in the first exuberance of infancy that we cry for the moon. None of the strong men in the strong ages would have understood what you meant by working for efficiency. Hildebrand would have said he was working not for efficiency, but for the Catholic Church. Danton would have said that he was working not for efficiency, but for liberty, equality, and fraternity. Even if the ideal of such men were simply the ideal of kicking a man downstairs, they thought of the end like men, not of the process like paralytics. They did not say, efficiently elevating my right leg, using it, you will notice the muscles of the thigh and calf, which are in excellent order. Their feeling was quite different. They were so filled with the beautiful vision of the man lying flat at the foot of the staircase that in that ecstasy, the rest followed in a flash. In practice, the habit of generalizing and idealizing did not by any means mean worldly weakness. The time of big theories was the time of big results. In the era of sentiment and fine words at the end of the 18th century, men were really robust and effective. The sentimentalists conquered Napoleon. The cynics would not catch DeWitt. 100 years ago, our affairs for good or evil were wielded triumphantly by rhetoricians. Now our affairs are hopelessly muddled by strong, silent men. And just as this repudiation of big words and big visions has brought forth a race of small men in politics, so it has brought forth a race of small men in the arts. Our modern politicians claim the colossal license of Caesar and the Superman, claim that they are too practical to be pure and too patriotic to be moral. But the upshot of it all is that a mediocrity is Chancellor of the Exchequer. Our new artistic philosophers call for the same moral license, for a freedom to wreck heaven and earth with their energy. But the upshot of it all is that a mediocrity is poet laureate. I do not say that there are no stronger men than these. But will anyone say that there are any men stronger than those men of old who were dominated by their philosophy and steeped in their religion? Whether bondage be better than freedom may be discussed. But that their bondage came to more than our freedom, it will be difficult for anyone to deny. The theory of the unmorality of art has established itself firmly in the strictly artistic classes. They are free to produce anything they like. They are free to write A Paradise Lost, in which Satan shall conquer God. They are free to write A Divine Comedy, in which heaven shall be under the floor of hell. And what have they done? Have they produced in their universality anything grander or more beautiful than the things uttered by the fierce Ghibelline Catholic? By the rigid Puritan schoolmaster? We know that they have produced only a few roundels. Milton does not merely beat them at his piety, he beats them at their own irreverence. In all their little books of verse, you will not find a finer defiance of God than Satan's. Nor will you find the grandeur of paganism felt as that fiery Christian felt it who described Farinata lifting his head in his disdain of hell. And the reason is very obvious. Blasphemy is an artistic effect because blasphemy depends upon a philosophical conviction. Blasphemy depends upon belief and is fading with it. If anyone doubts this, let him sit down seriously and try to think blasphemous thoughts about Thor. I think his family will find him at the end of the day in a state of some exhaustion. Neither in the world of politics nor that of literature, then, has the rejection of general theories proved a success. It may be that there have been many moonstruck and misleading ideals that have from time to time perplexed mankind. But assuredly there has been no ideal in practice so moonstruck and misleading as the ideal of practicality. Nothing has lost so many opportunities as the opportunism of Lord Rosebery. He is indeed a standing symbol of this epoch. A man who is theoretically a practical man and practically more unpractical than any theorist. Nothing in this universe is so unwise as that kind of worship of worldly wisdom. A man who is perpetually thinking of whether this race or that race is strong, of whether this cause or that cause is promising, is the man who will never believe in anything long enough to make it succeed. The opportunist politician is like a man who should abandon billiards because he was beaten at billiards, and abandon golf because he was beaten at golf. There is nothing which is so weak for working purposes as this enormous importance attached to immediate victory. There is nothing that fails like success. And having discovered that opportunism does fail, I have been induced to look at it more largely, and in consequence to see that it must fail. I perceive that it is far more practical to begin at the beginning and discuss theories. I see that the men who killed each other about the orthodoxy of the Homo Oceans were far more sensible than the people who are quarreling about the Education Act. For the Christian dogmatists were trying to establish a reign of holiness and trying to get defined, first of all, what was really holy. But our modern educationists are trying to bring about a religious liberty without attempting to settle what is religion or what is liberty. If the old priests forced a statement on mankind, at least they previously took some trouble to make it lucid. It has been left for the modern mobs of Anglicans and nonconformists to persecute for a doctrine without even stating it. For these reasons, and for many more, I for one have come to believe in going back to fundamentals. Such is the general idea of this book. I wish to deal with my most distinguished contemporaries, not personally or in a merely literary manner, but in relation to the real body of doctrine which they teach. I'm not concerned with Mr. Rudyard Kipling as a vivid artist or a vigorous personality. I am concerned with him as a heretic. That is to say, a man whose view of things has the hardihood to differ from mine. I'm not concerned with Mr. Bernard Shaw as one of the most brilliant and one of the most honest men alive. I am concerned with him as a heretic. That is to say, a man whose philosophy is quite solid, quite coherent, and quite wrong. I revert to the doctrinal methods of the 13th century, inspired by the general hope of getting something done. Suppose that a great commotion arises in the street about something, let us say a lamp post, which many influential persons desire to pull down. A gray-clad monk who is the spirit of the Middle Ages is approached upon the matter and begins to say, in the arid manner of the schoolmen, "Let us first of all consider, my brethren, the value of light, if light be in itself good." At this point he is somewhat excusably knocked down. All the people make a rush for the lamppost. The lamppost is down in 10 minutes, and they go about congratulating each other on their unmedieval practicality. But as things go on, they do not work out so easily. Some people have pulled the lamppost down because they wanted the electric light. Some because they wanted old iron. Some because they wanted darkness, because their deeds were evil. Some thought it not enough of a lamppost, some too much. Some acted because they wanted to smash municipal machinery. Some because they wanted to smash something. And there is war in the night, no man knowing whom he strikes. So gradually and inevitably, today, tomorrow, or the next day, there comes back the conviction that the monk was right after all, and that all depends on what is the philosophy of light. Only what we might have discussed under the gas lamp, we now must discuss in the dark. Chapter 2. On the Negative Spirit. Much has been said, and said truly, of the monkish morbidity, of the hysteria which has often gone with the visions of hermits or nuns. But let us never forget that this visionary religion is, in one sense, necessarily more wholesome than our modern and reasonable morality. It is more wholesome for this reason, that it can contemplate the idea of success or triumph in the hopeless fight towards the ethical ideal. In what Stevenson called, with his usual startling felicity, the lost fight of virtue. A modern morality, on the other hand, can only point with absolute conviction to the horrors that follow breaches of law. Its only certainty is a certainty of ill. It can only point to imperfection. It has no perfection to point to. But the monk meditating upon Christ or Buddha has in his mind an image of perfect health, a thing of clear colors and clean air. He may contemplate this ideal wholeness and happiness far more than he ought. He may contemplate it to the neglect of exclusion of essential things. He may contemplate it until he has become a dreamer or a driveler. but still it is wholeness and happiness that he is contemplating. He may even go mad, but he is going mad for the love of sanity. But the modern student of ethics, even if he remains sane from an insane dread of insanity. The anchorite rolling on the stones in a frenzy of submission is a healthier person fundamentally than many a sober man in a silk hat who is walking down Cheapside. For many such are good only through a withering knowledge of evil. I am not at this moment claiming for the devotee anything more than this primary advantage, that though he may be making himself personally weak and miserable, he is still fixing his thoughts largely on gigantic strength and happiness, on a strength that has no limits and a happiness that has no end. Doubtless there are other objections which can be urged without unreason against the influence of gods and visions in morality, whether in the cell or street. But this advantage the mystic morality must always have. It is always jollier. A young man may keep himself from vice by continually thinking of disease. He may keep himself from it also by continually thinking of the Virgin Mary. There may be question about whether which method is the more reasonable or even about which is the more efficient. But surely there can be no question about which is the more wholesome. I remember a pamphlet by that able and sincere secularist Mr. G.W. Foote, which contained a phrase sharply symbolizing and dividing those two methods. The pamphlet was called Beer and Bible, those two very noble things, and the nobler for a conjunction which Mr. Foote, in his stern old Puritan way, seemed to think sardonic, but which I confess to thinking appropriate and charming. I have not the work by me, but I remember that Mr. Foote dismissed very contemptuously any attempts to deal with the problem of strong drink by religious offices or intercessions, and said that a picture of a drunkard's liver would be more efficacious in the matter of temperance than any prayer or praise. In that picturesque expression, it seems to me, is perfectly embodied the incurable morbidity of modern ethics. In that temple, the lights are low, the crowds kneel, the solemn anthems are uplifted, but that upon the altar to which all men kneel is no longer the perfect flesh, the body and substance of the perfect man. It is still flesh, but it is diseased. It is the drunkard's liver of the New Testament that is marred for us, which we take in remembrance of him. Now, it is this great gap in modern ethics, the absence of vivid pictures and purity and spiritual triumph, which lies at the back of the real objection felt by so many sane men to the realistic literature of the 19th century. If any ordinary man ever said that he was horrified by the subjects discussed in Ibsen or Maupassant, or by the plain language in which they are spoken of, that ordinary man was lying. The average conversation of average men throughout the whole of modern civilization in every class or trade is such as Zola would never dream of printing. Nor is the habit of writing thus of these things a new habit. On the contrary, it is the Victorian prudery and silence which is new still, though it is already dying. The tradition of calling a spade starts very early in our literature and comes down very late. But the truth is that the ordinary honest man, whatever vague account he may have given of his feelings, was not either disgusted or even annoyed at the candor of the moderns. What disgusted him, and very justly, was not the presence of a clear realism, but the absence of a clear idealism. Strong and genuine religious sentiment has never had any objection to realism. On the contrary, religion was the realistic thing, the brutal thing, the thing that called names. This is the great difference between some recent developments of nonconformity and the great Puritanism of the 17th century. It was the whole point of the Puritans that they cared nothing for decency. Modern nonconformist newspapers distinguish themselves by suppressing precisely those nouns and adjectives which the founders of nonconformity distinguished themselves by flinging at kings and queens. But if it was a chief claim of religion that it spoke plainly about evil, it was the chief claim of all that it spoke plainly about good. The thing which is resented, and as I think, rightly resented, is that great modern literature in which Ibsen is typical, and that while the eye can perceive what are the wrong things increases in an uncanny and devouring clarity, the eye which sees what things are right is growing mistier and mistier every moment, till it goes almost blind with doubt. If we compare, let us say, the morality of the Divine Comedy with the morality of Ibsen's Ghosts, we shall see all that modern ethics have really done. No one, I imagine, will accuse the author of The Inferno of an early Victorian prudishness or a Podsnapian optimism, but Dante described three moral instruments: heaven, purgatory, and hell, the vision of perfection, the vision of improvement, the vision of failure. Ibsen has only one, hell. It is often said, and with perfect truth, that no one could read a play like Ghosts and remain indifferent to the necessity of an ethical self-command. That is quite true, and the same is to be said of the most monstrous and material descriptions of the eternal fire. It is quite certain the realists like Zola do in one sense promote morality. They promote it in the sense in which the hangman promotes it, in the sense in which the devil promotes it. But they only affect that small minority which will accept any virtue of courage. Most healthy people dismiss these moral dangers as they dismiss the possibility of bombs or microbes. Modern realists are indeed terrorists, like the dynamiters, and they fail just as much in their effort to create a thrill. Both realists and dynamiters are well-meaning people engaged in the task, so obviously ultimately hopeless, of using science to promote morality. I do not wish the reader to confuse me for a moment with those vague persons who imagine that Ibsen is what they call a pessimist. There are plenty of wholesome people in Ibsen, plenty of good people, plenty of happy people, plenty of examples of men acting wisely and things ending well. That is not my meaning. My meaning is that Ibsen has throughout and does not disguise a certain vagueness and a changing attitude, as well as a doubting attitude towards what is really wisdom and virtue in this life. A vagueness which contrasts very remarkably with the decisiveness with which he pounces on something which he perceives to be a root of evil. Some convention, some deception, some ignorance. We know that the hero of Ghosts is mad, and we know why he is mad. We do also know that Dr. Stockman is sane, but we do not know why he is sane. Ibsen does not profess to know how virtue and happiness are brought about, in the sense that he professes to know how our modern sexual tragedies are brought about. Falsehood works ruin in the pillars of society, but truth works equal ruin in the wild duck. There are no cardinal virtues of Ibsenism. There is no ideal man of Ibsen. All this is not only admitted, but vaunted in the most valuable and thoughtful of all the eulogies upon Ibsen, Mr. Bernard Shaw's Quintessence of Ibsenism. Mr. Shaw sums up Ibsen's teaching in the phrase, "The golden rule is that there is no golden rule." In his eyes, this absence of an enduring and positive ideal, this absence of a permanent key to virtue, is the one great Ibsen merit. I am not discussing now with any fullness whether this is so or not. All I venture to point out with an increased firmness is that this omission, good or bad, does leave us face to face with the problem of a human consciousness, filled with very definite images of evil, and with no definite image of good. To us, light must be henceforward the dark thing, the thing of which we cannot speak. To us, as to Milton's Devils in Pandemonium, it is darkness that is visible. The human race, according to religion, fell once, and in falling gained knowledge of good and of evil. Now we have fallen a second time, and only the knowledge of evil remains to us. A great silent collapse, an enormous unspoken disappointment, has in our time fallen on our northern civilization. All previous ages have sweated and been crucified in an attempt to realize what is really the right life. What was really the good man? A definite part of the modern world has come beyond question to the conclusion that there is no answer to these questions, and that the most we can do is to set up a few notice boards at places of obvious danger to warn men, for instance, against drinking themselves to death or ignoring the mere existence of their neighbors. Ibsen is the first to return from the baffled hunt to bring us the tidings of great failure. Every one of the popular modern phrases and ideals is a dodge in order to shirk the problem of what is good. We are fond of talking about liberty, that, as we talk of it, is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. We are fond of talking about progress. That is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. We are fond of talking about education. That is a dodge to avoid discussing what is good. The modern man says, "Let us leave all these arbitrary standards and embrace liberty." This is logically rendered, "Let us not decide what is good, but let it be considered good not to decide it." He says, "Away with your old moral formulae. I am for progress." This, logically stated, means let us not settle what is good, but let us settle whether we are getting more of it. He says, "Neither in religion nor morality, my friend, lie the hopes of the race, but in education." This, clearly expressed, means we cannot decide what is good, but let us give it to our children. Mr. H.G. Wells, that exceedingly clear-sighted man, has pointed out in a recent work that this has happened in connection with economic questions. The old economists, he says, made generalizations, and they were, in Mr. Wells's view, mostly wrong. But the new economists, he says, seem to have lost the power of making any generalizations at all. And they cover this incapacity with a general claim to be, in specific cases, regarded as experts. A claim proper enough in a hairdresser or a fashionable physician, but indecent in a philosopher or a man of science. But in spite of the refreshing rationality with which Mr. Wells has indicated this, it must also be said that he himself has fallen into the same enormous modern error. In the opening pages of that excellent book, Mankind in the Making, he dismisses the ideals of art, religion, abstract morality, and the rest, and says that he is going to consider men in their chief function, the function of parenthood. He is going to discuss life as a tissue of births. He is not going to ask what will produce satisfactory saints or satisfactory heroes, but what will produce satisfactory fathers and mothers. The whole is set forward so sensibly that it is a few moments at least before the reader realizes that it is another example of unconscious shirking. What is the good of begetting a man until we have settled what is the good of being a man? You are merely handing on to him a problem you dare not settle yourself. It is as if a man were asked, "What is the use of a hammer?" and answered, "To make hammers." And when asked, "And of those hammers, what is the use?" answered, "To make hammers again." Just as such a man would be perpetually putting off the question of the ultimate use of carpentry. So Mr. Wells and all the rest of us are by these phrases successfully putting off the question of the ultimate value of the human life. The case of the general talk of progress is indeed an extreme one. As enunciated today, progress is simply a comparative of which we have not settled the superlative. We meet every ideal of religion, patriotism, beauty, or brute pleasure with the alternative ideal of progress. That is to say, we meet every proposal of getting something that we know about with an alternative proposal of getting a great deal more of nobody knows what. Progress, properly understood, has indeed a most dignified and legitimate meaning, but as used in opposition to precise moral ideals, it is ludicrous. So far from it being the truth that the ideal of progress is to be set against that of ethical or religious finality, the reverse is the truth. Nobody has any business to use the word progress unless he has a definite creed and a cast-iron code of morals. Nobody can be progressive without being doctrinal. I might almost say that nobody can be progressive without being infallible. At any rate, without believing in some infallibility. For progress by its very name indicates a direction, and the moment we are in the least doubtful about the direction, we become in the same degree doubtful about the progress. Never, perhaps, since the beginning of the world has there been an age that had less right to use the word progress than we. In the Catholic 12th century and the philosophic 18th century, the direction may have been a good or a bad one. Men may have differed more or less about how far they went and in what direction. But about the direction, they did in the main agree, and consequently they had the genuine sensation of progress. But it is precisely about the direction that we disagree. Whether the future excellence lies in more law or less law, in more liberty or less liberty, whether property will be finally concentrated or finally cut up, whether sexual passion will reach its sanest in an almost virgin intellectualism or in a full animal freedom, whether we should love everybody with Tolstoy or spare nobody with Nietzsche, these are the things about which we are actually fighting most. It is not merely true that the age which has settled least what is progress is this progressive age. It is, moreover, true that the people who have settled least what is progress are the most progressive people in it. The ordinary mass, the men who have never troubled about progress, might be trusted, perhaps, to progress. The particular individuals who talk about progress would certainly fly to the four winds of heaven when the pistol shot started the race. I do not, therefore, say that the word progress is unmeaning. I say it is unmeaning without the previous definition of a moral doctrine, and that it can only be applied to groups of persons who hold that doctrine in common. Progress is not an illegitimate word, but it is logically evident that it is illegitimate for us. It is a sacred word, a word which could only rightly be used by rigid believers and in the ages of faith. Chapter 3. On Mr. Rudyard Kipling and Making the World Small. There is no such thing on earth as an uninteresting subject. The only thing that can exist is an uninterested person. Nothing is more keenly required than a defense of bores. When Byron divided humanity into the bores and bored, he omitted to notice that the higher qualities exist entirely in the bores, the lower qualities in the bored, among whom he counted himself. The bore, by his starry enthusiasm, his solemn happiness, may, in some sense, have proved himself poetical. The bored has certainly proved himself prosaic. We might, no doubt, find it a nuisance to count all the blades of grass or all the leaves of the trees, but this would not be because of our boldness or gaiety, but because of our lack of boldness and gaiety. The boar would go onward, bold and gay, and find the blades of grass as splendid as the swords of an army. The boar is stronger and more joyous than we are. He is a demigod. Nay, he is a god. For it is the gods who do not tire of the iteration of things. To them the nightfall is always new, and the last rose as red as the first. The sense that everything is poetical is a thing solid and absolute. It is not a mere matter of phraseology or persuasion. It is not merely true. It is ascertainable. Men may be challenged to deny it. Men may be challenged to mention anything that is not a matter of poetry. I remember a long time ago a sensible sub-editor coming up to me with a book in his hand called Mr. Smith or The Smith Family or some such thing. He said, "Well, you won't get any of your damned mysticism out of this," or words to that effect. I am happy to say that I undeceived him, but the victory was too obvious and easy. In most cases, the name is unpoetical, although the fact is poetical. In the case of Smith, the name is so poetical that it must be an arduous and heroic matter for the man to live up to it. The name of Smith is the name of the one trade that even kings respected. It could claim half the glory of that arma virumque, which all epics acclaimed. The spirit of the smithy is so close to the spirit of song that it has mixed in a million poems. And every blacksmith is a harmonious blacksmith. Even the village children feel that in some dim way the smith is poetic, as the grocer and the cobbler are not poetic, when they feast on the dancing sparks and deafening blows in the cavern of that creative violence. The brute repose of nature, that passionate cunning of man, the strongest of earthly metals, the weirdest of earthly elements, the unconquerable iron subdued by its only conqueror, The wheel and the plowshare, the sword and the steam hammer, the arraying of armies, and the whole legend of arms. All these things are written briefly indeed and quite legibly on the visiting card of Mr. Smith. Yet our novelists call their hero Aylmer Valance, which means nothing, or Vernon Raymond, which means nothing, when it is in their power to give him this sacred name of Smith. This name made of iron and flame, it would be very natural if a certain hauteur, a certain carriage of the head, a certain curl of the lip distinguished everyone whose name is Smith. Perhaps it does. I trust so. Whoever else are Parvenus, the Smiths are not Parvenus. From the darkest dawn of history, this clan has gone forth to battle. Its trophies are on every hand. Its name is everywhere. It is older than the nations, and its sign is the hammer of Thor. But as I also remarked, it is not quite the usual case. It is common enough that common things should be poetical. It is not so common that common names should be poetical. In most cases, it is the name that is the obstacle. A great many people talk as if this claim of ours, that all things are poetical, were a mere literary ingenuity, a play on words. Precisely the contrary is true. It is the idea that some things are not poetical, which is literary, which is a mere product of words. The word signal box is unpoetical, but the thing signal box is not unpoetical. It is a place where men, in an agony of vigilance, light blood red and sea-green fires to keep other men from death. That is the plain, genuine description of what it is. The prose only comes in with what it is called. The word pillar box is unpoetical, but the thing pillar box is not unpoetical. It is the place to which friends and lovers commit their messages, conscious that when they have done so, they are sacred and not to be touched, not only by others, but even religious touch by themselves. That red turret is one of the last of the temples. Posting a letter and getting married are among the few things left that are entirely romantic. For to be entirely romantic, a thing must be irrevocable. We think a pillar box prosaic because there is no rhyme to it. We think a pillar box unpoetical because we have never seen it in a poem. But the bold fact is entirely on the side of poetry. A signal box is only called a signal box. It is a house of life and death. A pillar box is only called a pillar box. It is a sanctuary of human words. If you think the name of Smith prosaic, it is not because you are practical and sensible. It is because you are too much affected with literary refinements. The name shouts poetry at you. If you think of it otherwise, it is because you are steeped and sodden with verbal reminiscences, because you remember everything in Punch or comic cuts about Mr. Smith being drunk or Mr. Smith being henpecked. All these things were given to you poetical. It is only by a long and elaborate process of literary effort that you have made them prosaic. Now, the first and fairest thing to say about Rudyard Kipling is that he has borne a brilliant part in thus recovering the lost provinces of poetry. He has not been frightened by that brutal materialistic air which clings only to words. He has pierced through to the romantic imaginative matter of the things themselves. He has pierced the significance and philosophy of steam and of slang. Steam may be, if you like, a dirty byproduct of science. Slang may be, if you like, a dirty byproduct of language. But at least he has been among the few who saw the divine parentage of these things and knew that where there is smoke, there is fire. That is, that wherever there is the foulest of things, there is also the purest. Above all, he has had something to say, a definite view of things to utter, and that always means that a man is fearless and faces everything. For the moment we have a view of the universe, we possess it. Now the message of Rudyard Kipling, that upon which he has really concentrated, is the only thing worth worrying about in him or in any other man. He has often written bad poetry, like Wordsworth. He has often said silly things, like Plato. He has often given way to mere political hysteria like Gladstone. But no one can reasonably doubt that he means steadily and sincerely to say something, and the only serious question is, What is that which he has tried to say? Perhaps the best way of stating this fairly will be to begin with that element which has been most insisted by himself and by his opponents. I mean his interest in militarism. But when we are seeking for the real merits of a man, it is unwise to go to his enemies and much more foolish to go to himself. Now, Mr. Kipling is certainly wrong in his worship of militarism, but his opponents are, generally speaking, quite as wrong as he. The evil of militarism is not that it shows certain men to be fierce and haughty and excessively warlike. The evil of militarism is that it shows most men to be tame and timid and excessively peaceable. The professional soldier gains more and more power as the general courage of a community declines. Thus, the Praetorian Guard became more and more important in Rome as Rome became more and more luxurious and feeble. The military man gains the civil power in proportion as the civilian loses the military virtues. And as it was in ancient Rome, so it is in contemporary Europe. There never was a time when nations were more militarist. There never was a time when men were less brave. All ages and all epochs have sung of arms and the man. But we have effected simultaneously the deterioration of the man and the fantastic perfection of the arms. Militarism demonstrated the decadence of Rome, and it demonstrates the decadence of Prussia. And unconsciously, Mr. Kipling has proved this and proved it admirably. For insofar as his work is earnestly understood, the military trade does not by any means emerge as the most important or attractive. He has not written so well about soldiers as he is about railway men or bridge builders or even journalists. The fact is that what attracts Mr. Kipling to militarism is not the idea of courage, but the idea of discipline. There was far more courage to the square mile in the Middle Ages, when no king had a standing army, but every man had a bow or a sword. But the fascination of the standing army upon Mr. Kipling is not courage, which scarcely interests him, but discipline, which is, when all is said and done, his primary theme. The modern army is not a miracle of courage. It has not enough opportunities, owing to the cowardice of everybody else. But it is really a miracle of organization, and that is the truly Kiplingite ideal. Kipling's subject is not that valor which properly belongs to war, but that interdependence and efficiency which belongs quite as much to engineers or sailors or mules or railway engines. And thus it is that when he writes of engineers or sailors or mules or steam engines, he writes at his best. The real poetry, the true romance which Mr. Kipling has taught, is the romance of the division of labor and the discipline of all the trades. He sings the arts of peace much more accurately than the arts of war. And his main contention is vital and valuable. Everything is military in the sense that everything depends upon obedience. There is no perfectly Epicurean corner. There is no perfectly irresponsible place. Everywhere men have made the way for us with sweat and submission. We may fling ourselves into a hammock in a fit of divine carelessness. But we are glad that the net maker did not make the hammock in a fit of divine carelessness. We may jump upon a child's rocking horse for a joke, but we are glad that the carpenter did not leave the legs of it unglued for a joke. So far from having merely preached that a soldier cleaning his sidearm is to be adored because he is military, Kipling at his best and clearest has preached that the baker baking loaves and the tailor cutting coats is as military as anybody. Being devoted to this multitudinous vision of duty, Mr. Kipling is naturally a cosmopolitan. He happens to find his examples in the British Empire, but almost any other empire would do as well, or, indeed, any other highly civilized country. That which he admires in the British Army he would find even more apparent in the German Army. That which he desires in the British police he would find flourishing in the French police. The ideal of discipline is not the whole of life, but it is spread over the whole of the world. And the worship of it tends to confirm in Mr. Kipling a certain note of worldly wisdom, of the experience of the wanderer, which is one of the genuine charms of his best work. The great gap in his mind is what may be roughly called the lack of patriotism. That is to say, he lacks altogether the faculty of attaching himself to any cause or community finally and tragically. for all finality must be tragic. He admires England, but he does not love her. For we admire things with reasons, but love them without reasons. He admires England because she is strong, not because she is English. There is no harshness in saying this, for to do him justice, he avows it with his usual picturesque candor. In a very interesting poem, he says that if England was what England seems, that is, weak and inefficient, if England were not what, as he believes, she is, that is, powerful and practical, how quick we'd chuck her, but she ain't. He admits, that is, that his devotion is the result of a criticism, and this is quite enough to put it in another category altogether from the patriotism of the Boers, whom he hounded down in South Africa. And speaking of the really patriotic peoples, such as the Irish, he has some difficulty in keeping a shrill irritation out of his language. The frame of mind which he really describes with beauty and nobility is the frame of mind of the cosmopolitan man who has seen men and cities. For to admire and for to see, for to behold this world so wide. He is a perfect master of that light melancholy with which a man looks back on having been the citizen of many communities. Of that light melancholy with which a man looks back on having been the lover of many women. He is the philanderer of the nations. But a man may have learnt much about women in flirtations and still be ignorant of first love. A man may have known as many lands as Ulysses and still be ignorant of patriotism. Mr. Rudyard Kipling has asked in a celebrated epigram what they can know of England who know England only. It is a far deeper and sharper question to ask. What can they know of England who know only the world? For the world does not include England any more than it includes the church. The moment we care for anything deeply, the world, that is, all the other miscellaneous interests, becomes our enemy. Christians showed it when they talked of keeping oneself unspotted from the world. But lovers talk of it just as much when they talk of the world well lost. Astronomically speaking, I understand that England is situated on the world. Similarly, I suppose that the church was a part of the world, and even the lovers inhabitants of that orb. But they all felt a certain truth. The truth that the moment you love anything, the world becomes your foe. Thus, Mr. Kipling does certainly know the world. He is a man of the world with all the narrowness that belongs to those imprisoned in that planet. He knows England as an intelligent English gentleman knows Venice. He has been to England a great many times. He has stopped there for long visits, but he does not belong to it or to any place. And the proof of it is this, that he thinks of England as a place. The moment we are rooted in a place, the place vanishes. We live like a tree with the whole strength of the universe. The globetrotter lives in a smaller world than the peasant. He is always breathing an air of locality. London is a place to be compared to Chicago. Chicago is a place to be compared to Timbuktu. But Timbuktu is not a place, since there at least live men who regard it as the universe and breathe not an air of locality, but the winds of the world. The man in the saloon steamer has seen all the races of men, and he is thinking of the things that divide men. Diet, dress, decorum, rings in the nose as in Africa, or in the ears as in Europe, blue paint among the ancients, or red paint among the modern Britons. The man in the cabbage field has seen nothing at all, but he is thinking of the things that unite men, hunger and babies, and the beauty of women, and the promise or menace of the sky. Mr. Kipling, with all his merits, is the globetrotter. He has not the patience to become part of anything. So great and genuine a man is not to be accused of a merely cynical cosmopolitanism. Still, his cosmopolitanism is his weakness. That weakness is splendidly expressed in one of his finest poems, The Sestina of the Tramp Royal, in which a man declares that he can endure anything in the way of hunger or horror, but not permanent presence in one place. In this, there is certainly danger. The more dead and dry and dusty a thing is, the more it travels about. Dust is like this, and the thistledown and the High Commissioner in South Africa. Fertile things are somewhat heavier, like the heavy fruit trees on the pregnant mud of the Nile. In the heated idleness of youth, we were all rather inclined to quarrel with the implication of that proverb which says that a rolling stone gathers no moss. We were inclined to ask, who wants to gather moss except silly old ladies? But for all that, we begin to perceive that the proverb is right. The rolling stone rolls echoing from rock to rock, but the rolling stone is dead. The moss is silent because the moss is alive. The truth is that exploration and enlargement make the world smaller. The telegraph and the steamboat make the world smaller. The telescope makes the world smaller. It is only the microscope that makes it larger. Before long, the world will be cloven with a war between the telescopists and the microscopists. The first study large things and live in a small world. The second study small things and live in a large world. It is inspiriting without doubt to whiz in a motor car round the earth, to feel Arabia as a whirl of sand or China as a flash of rice fields. But Arabia is not a world of sand, and China is not a flash of rice fields. They are ancient civilizations with strange virtues buried like treasures. If we wish to understand them, it must not be as tourists or inquirers. It must be with the loyalty of children and the great patience of poets. To conquer these places is to lose them. The man standing in his own kitchen garden with fairyland opening at the gate is the man with large ideas. His mind creates distance. The motor car stupidly destroys it. Moderns think of the earth as a globe, as something one can easily get around, the spirit of a schoolmistress. This is shown in the odd mistake perpetually made about Cecil Rhodes. His enemies say that he may have had large ideas, but he was a bad man. His friends say that he may have been a bad man, but he certainly had large ideas. The truth is that he was not a man essentially bad. He was a man of much geniality and many good intentions, but a man with singularly small views. There is nothing large about painting the map red. It is an innocent game for children. It is just as easy to think in continents as to think in cobblestones. The difficulty comes in when we seek to know the substance of either of them. Rhodes's prophecies about the Boer resistance are an admirable comment on how the large ideas prosper when it is not a question of thinking in continents, but of understanding a few two-legged men. And under all this vast illusion of the cosmopolitan planet with its empires and its Reuters agency, the real life of man goes on concerned with this tree or that temple, with this harvest or that drinking song, totally uncomprehended, totally untouched. And it watches from its splendid parochialism, possibly with a smile of amusement, motor car civilization going its triumphant way, outstripping time, consuming space, seeing all and seeing nothing, roaring on at last to the capture of the solar system, only to find the sun cockney and the stars suburban. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.